Hello and welcome to a new season of a Northern Counties Paranormal Podcast, hosted by Within the Boggart Wood. Year one finished at the end of February, and I've ended up taking a slightly longer break than planned simply due to workload on my day job. So what's planned for year two? More of the same in most cases, as the feedback I've received on the first 23 episodes suggest I'm doing at least something vaguely right. However, I am hoping to have more guests and discussions on the podcast this year, and while I will still focus on the north of England and the Scottish borders, the plan is to expand geographically, especially when it comes to trawling the old newspaper archives for stories, as the northern articles of interest are finite. I've also been expanding my Cumbrian and Scottish borders folklore volume collection, so I'll be bringing more material from these regions into the podcast than I did in year one. So now for some general housekeeping. Since the last episode, I've temporarily closed down the merch store, as a few of the samples I'd received from the producer just weren't up to scratch. So if anyone listening can recommend a good merch supplier, I'd be grateful if you'd let me know. Also, the podcast has a new Patreon subscriber. I'd like to extend a massive thank you to Gail Fiddler for her support. So without further ado, let's look at today's first story. Now this podcast will first go live on Easter Sunday 2024, so I'd like to say a happy Easter to anyone who celebrates this weekend in any of its multiple forms. I'd thought initially about doing this episode on the origins of Easter as a holiday, but a lot of other podcasts have done the same, so while I'll include some of the Easter traditions and superstitions at the end of the episode, I thought instead I'd look at some different tales of rebirth, for want of a better term. So, turning back time to the end of the 12th century, an Augustinian canon by the name of William Parvus, or William of Newburgh, was travelling the country composing his work, The History of English Affairs, which, as the name suggests, was a history of England at that time. Parvus was extremely critical of writers such as Geoffrey of Monmouth, who he regarded as pretty much just making everything up as he went along, but while Parvus's work is a treasure trove for historians, he also took the time to write down some rather interesting tales of what we'd now call the paranormal, but which at the time were seen as acts of the devil. The following extract from his work, an account of an incident which occurred in AD 1196, has been translated from the original Latin, not by me, I hasten to add, but for those interested and able, I'll put links to the Latin works in the episode description, along with the links to the translation. At the mouth of the River Tweed, and in the jurisdiction of the King of Scotland, there stands a noble city which is called Berwick. In this town a certain man, very wealthy, but as it afterwards appeared a great rogue, having been buried after his death, sallied forth, by the contrivance, as it is believed, of Satan, out of his grave at night, and was borne hither and thither, pursued by a pack of dogs with loud barkings, thus striking great terror into the neighbours, and returning to his tomb before daylight. After this had continued for several days, and no one dared to be found out of doors after dusk, for each dreaded an encounter with this deadly monster, the higher and middle classes of the people held a necessary investigation into what was requisite to be done. The more simple among them fearing, in the event of negligence, to be soundly beaten by this prodigy of the grave, but the wiser shrewdly concluding that were the remedy further delayed, the atmosphere infected and corrupted by the constant whirlings through it of the pestiferous corpse would engender disease and death to a great extent, the necessity of providing against which was shown by frequent examples in similar cases. They therefore procured 10 young men renowned for boldness, who were to dig up the horrible carcass, and, having cut it limb from limb, reduce it into food and fuel for the flames. When this was done, the commotion ceased. Moreover, it is stated that the monster, while it was being borne about, as it is said by Satan, had told certain persons, whom it had by chance encountered, that as long as it had remained unburned, the people should have no peace. Being burnt, tranquility appeared to be restored to them, but a pestilence, which arose in consequence, carried off the greater portion of them, for never did it so furiously rage elsewhere, though it was at that time a general throughout all the borders of England, as shall be more fully explained in its proper place. This account has been translated by modern folklorists into claiming it to be the first account of a vampire in Berwick, and indeed the tale often appears embellished by the title The Vampire of Berwick, though I think for those more scholarly minded the term used for the creature in this case is a revenant. A revenant, according to the Oxford Dictionary, is a term simply for someone who has returned from the dead. It is also interesting that the creature in question in this case seemed to be blamed for a bout of plague, and indeed most of similar stories appear to be told to account for the plague rising in certain areas. According to Parvus, the Berwick case was not an isolated incident in the year 1196. He was informed by the Archdeacon of Buckingham that a man, upon his death, had been buried in a tomb on the eve of the Lord's Ascension, which was 40 days after Easter. The next night, though, the man rose from his tomb and entered his home, waking his wife and, to quote, "nearly crushed her by the insupportable weight of his body." He returned to his tomb before dawn, but then the same occurred the next night. Then on the third night, his wife remained awake and surrounded herself with friends. When night fell, once again her dead husband came to the house, but her friends drove him away. The revenant then turned his attention on his own brothers, who lived in the same street, but found them awake and surrounded by their own companions, having heard the stories of him stalking the night. Turned away from their houses, the creature then took out his frustrations on the village animals. After that, every village in the house set watch at night time, but it wasn't long before the creature began to appear around the village during daylight hours. Strangely though, it was reported that he was only visible to some of the villagers, not to others, and soon the village turned to the church for help. The archdeacon heard the case first, then went to the Bishop of Lincoln. The bishop consulted with colleagues who, to quote, said that such things had often befallen in England, and cited frequent examples to show that tranquility could not be restored to the people until the body of this most wretched man were dug up and burnt. However, the bishop thought that such an act was improper, and instead wrote a letter of absolution. The tomb was then opened, whereupon the body of the man was found to be in the same condition in which it had been buried. The letter was placed on the man's chest, then the tomb closed again, and from that point on the revenant no longer appeared in the village and the man seemed to be at rest. Parvus, however, didn't stop there. He states, "Were I to write down all of the instances of this kind which I have ascertained to have befallen in our times, the undertaking would be beyond measure laborious and troublesome, so I will fain to add two more only, and these of recent occurrence, to those I have already narrated, and insert them in our history as occasion offers as a warning to posterity." The next story he tells, setting it in the early 1190s, is that of the Hunderprest, a chaplain to a lady based in Melrose who was consigned to a tomb in the monastery upon his death. He had been known as the Hunderprest or dog priest due to his love of the hunt, and pursued other pleasures of the flesh with the same vigour. Upon his death, though, it was said that the chaplain clambered from his tomb when the moon rose, but was repelled from the monastery by the holy men there. Instead, he headed to the bedchamber of his former mistress, which he haunted with loud groans and horrible murmurs. The lady soon took fright at his frequent visits, and she eventually spoke to it to one of the friars at the monastery. The next night, four friars held vigil in the cemetery, but by midnight the revenant had not appeared, and three of them retired to the nearest house to warm up, leaving a lone friar to remain on watch, armed with an axe. As soon as he was alone, the friar saw the creature rising from the tomb, but despite being very afraid, he held his ground and struck the revenant hard with the axe when the creature rushed him with a terrible growl. Wounded by the axe, the revenant fled for his tomb, which the friar described as opening of its own accord to allow the revenant to enter, and closing once he was back inside. At dawn, the friar and his companions dug up the corpse from within the tomb and found the gaping wound from the axe in the creature's flesh, along with, to quote, "a great quantity of gore which had flowed from it in the sepulchre." They took the body beyond the walls of the monastery and burnt it, then scattered the ashes to the winds. The fourth tale recounted by Parvus is the revenant of Anantis Castle. Now, there is no known Anantis Castle, and a question does arise as to where in the country the tale belongs. Anick Castle in Northumberland often claims the story, told as the vampire of Anick Castle, but it is also claimed by Annan Castle in Scotland. It could of course be another site entirely lost to history. Parvus states that the story was related to him by an aged monk from Anantis who witnessed the event. The tale goes that a man of evil conduct fled from the province of York to escape his enemies and took refuge in Anantis Castle, where the lord of the castle gave him a position that unfortunately allowed him to continue his evil pursuits. He married, but soon afterwards he heard rumours that his wife was being unfaithful. Determined to learn the truth, he pretended to go on a journey which he told his wife he wouldn't be back from in a few days. Instead, though, he hid himself on an overhanging beam over his wife's bedchamber and waited to see what happened. It wasn't long before his wife appeared with a young man from the village, and as they entertained each other, He grew angry and lost his balance on the beam, falling heavily to the floor onto his head. The young man escaped quickly from the room after his impact, but his wife helped him from the floor, and when he accused her of adultery, she said that what he'd seen was the result of a sickness he himself had. That night, presumably as a result of severe concussion, the man died in his sleep. His body received a Christian burial, but as night fell, the grave opened and he rose from the grave, where he wandered through the courts and houses of Anantis, pursued by a pack of howling dogs. People closed their doors against him, but as he moved around, his walking, bloated corpse breathed disease and plague wherever he visited. Soon the village was near on empty, with people fleeing for the countryside to escape the creature and its pestilence, and those that remained met with holy men on Palm Sunday. As the festivities of the day ended with banqueting, two brothers who had lost their father to the plague took it upon themselves to dig up the corpse during daylight hours and burn it. To quote Parvus, "Thereupon snatching up a spade of but indifferent sharpness of edge, and hastening to the cemetery, they began to dig. And whilst they were thinking that they would have to dig to a greater depth, they suddenly, before much of the earth had been removed, laid bare the corpse, swollen to an enormous corpulence, with its countenance beyond measure turgid and suffused with blood, while the napkin in which it had been wrapped appeared nearly torn to pieces. The young men, however, spurred on by wrath, feared not and inflicted a wound upon the senseless carcass, out of which incontinently flowed such a stream of blood that it might have been taken for a leech filled with the blood of many persons. Apparently, the brothers then dragged the remains beyond the village, constructed a pyre, then tore the creature's heart from its body with the spade. The body was then burnt on the pyre, and it was said that from that moment on the plague in the village died, and the creature was never again seen haunting the village." Today's From the Archives tale comes from the Caledonian Mercury, dated Monday 2nd of August 1790, and is simply entitled The Ghosts. Some time ago, a small house in Rutlandshire had a bad report of being haunted. A young fox hunter, who thought he should ride hard enough in the day to be tired at night, hired the house, in spite of Satan and all his works. The second night he was there, he was awaked by a figure all in white that seemed to look at him attentively. He happened to be a well-looking young man, and the fresh colour which health and youth had put into his cheek did not forsake them for fear. The figure approached the bed, and our hero got out of it to meet it. Flesh and spirit came nearer to each other, when, shame to say, the terrestrial conquered, and the apparition retired, to convince the gentleman that such things are after death. The consequence has been a young ghost. It seems a farmer and his wife, who held the garden while the house was untenanted, resolved no tenant should ever live there, and the lady, whenever anybody applied for the house, or attempted to occupy it, always appeared in a sheet. The fox hunter now boasts that he has, against any man in Christendom, the art of laying a ghost. Today's second story, which is a simple little tale, comes from Malestang in Cumbria. The location in question was a small farmhouse, where the occupants said that on the night of the birth of their daughter, they were disturbed by the sudden appearance of an apparition of a boy dressed in a flat cap and braces, but with his face shrouded, who the whole family witnessed walking into the room only to disappear through the wall. Over the months that followed, the apparition was seen a number of times again, and on one occasion a spectral voice was heard over the baby monitor, and when the family rushed up to the child, they found her alone and the room freezing cold. Interestingly, the farm was also in use as a bed and breakfast, and it wasn't long before guests started to comment on the strangely dressed boy around the place. The family consulted a medium, who claimed that the boy had lived in the farm years past, and was simply acting as a guardian to the baby, and that he'd likely vanish as the child got older. This appears to be exactly what happened, with the apparent sightings of the boy having stopped by the early 1990s. Now, a mile away from the farmhouse is an area known as Boggle Green, and it was said that the green was home to, as the name suggests, a boggle or goblin, which would cause chaos in the area. Local legend has it that during renovation works at a nearby Deepgill farm, three witch bottles full of crooked pins were discovered in the fireplace, but thrown away by the workmen. At that point, the farm was suddenly free to be haunted by the boggle, with doors crashing, lights flickering and turning themselves off and on, and even the workmen's tools vanishing. The farmer, it said, retrieved the witch bottles from the skip and put them back where the workmen had found them, and the strange activity stopped. This report comes from the 1960s or 70s, I can't work out which, but when researching the case, I found something interesting. In the book Tales and Legends of Westmoreland, compiled in 1862, so a century before the story just told, was the following statement. In Deepgill farmhouse, behind which rises a steep mountain, below Wild Boar, a man found under the flags a bottle full of crooked pins, said to belong to an old witch, who played sad spells all over the dale. Witchcraft being a favourite creed among all at the time, and cards used more than either Bible or prayer book. Henry Hugginson, who found this treasure, had a run of bad luck, and all his land wasted away, but no sooner was he ruined than he began to thrive ever after. So in this case, are we looking at new life being breathed into an old legend, or did that witch really, really like her bottles full of crooked pins? At the beginning of the episode, I said I would include some Easter traditions. So here you go, presented by William Henderson from his volume Notes on the Folklore of the Northern Counties of England and Borders, dated 1879. All over England, it is commonly said that one must put something new on Easter Sunday, else the birds will spoil one's clothes, or as it stands in verse, at Easter let your clothes be new, or else be sure you will it rue. The belief that the sun dances at its rising on Easter morning peeps out in many parts of Yorkshire, as well as in Durham and Northumberland. Here again, there is a singular correspondence between folklore of the north and the west. Devonshire maidens get up to see the sunrise on Easter morning, as duly as do their northern sisters, though what they look for is the lamb and flag in the centre of the sun's disc. Poor women in the neighbourhood of Dartmoor have told me that they used, as girls, to go out in parties at sunrise to see the lamb and the sun, and look at it through a darkened glass, as always some declared they saw it. As to Easter eggs, as they are duly painted and gilded and rolled on the green throughout the north of England, as they are in Russia and Germany. They are also given as little offerings of goodwill by one person to another. I believe their use chiefly prevails throughout countries in communion with the Easter Church. The egg is an obvious symbol of the resurrection of life in apparent death. Throughout Yorkshire, it is customary to hide the coloured eggs in little nests out of doors, and set the children to hunt after them, and see what eggs the hares have been laying. Another Easter custom, and one perhaps better honoured in the breach than in the observance, still lingers in Durham. In a Sunday school there, a scanty attendance of girls on Easter Day was recently accounted for by their being terrified lest the boys should pull off their shoes. Tomorrow, it was added, they may pull off the boys' caps. This frolic, whatever be its origin, seems to have extended into Yorkshire. At least, a friend tells me that she remembers when a little girl having her shoes pulled off one Easter on the sands of Redcar, and I have heard of a stout-hearted Yorkshire curate who used to go around his parish on Easter Sunday afternoon to collect the girls and pioneer them safely to church and school. This was the time of danger, for the young men had no right to take their shoes till after the morning service. I may add that in the West Riding, lurking, which is playing at gnaw and spell, begins at Easter, and that near York, tansy pudding used to be eaten on this festival in allusion to the bitter herbs at the Passover. So thanks for listening to this, the first episode of Season 2 and Episode 24 of the podcast. More information on the project can be found on the website at theboggartwood.uk, or within theboggartwood.org.uk, with the project's social media and Patreon links available in the episode description. One extra bit of news is that I'm currently working on setting up an old-style discussion forum for those who don't like social media, but it's not quite ready yet. So until next time, have a great weekend and stay safe.